countrywide on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by the Irish Farmers Journal. Get Irish Country Living, your magazine for rural Ireland, every week inside the Irish Farmers Journal. Countrywide on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by the Irish Farmers Journal, bringing 295,000 readers the latest farming news and the best of rural Ireland weekly.
Good morning and welcome to the programme. Coming up between now and 9 o'clock, the COVID impact on the food service sector, trouble accessing land for young farmers. What does the UK-Australian free trade deal mean for Irish and British beef farmers? And sowing spuds triggers memories of times past.
Text 51551, email countrywide at rte.ie and tweet at RTE Countrywide.
But first, it's Thursday afternoon and it's lashing rain.
What a day.
And I'm walking through a field with a young farmer in County Cavan.
And the sheep will soon have to be shorn.
Yeah, that'll be another thing on the agenda. And yesterday was so nice.
So yeah. Before we get started, how do you pronounce your second name?
It's Oro Fiamma.
This is Luna Oro Fiamma, a cattle and sheep farmer in Butler's Bridge, County Cavan.
I am, yes. So I have 8 cows and 8 calves here, and I also have 35 Suffolk ewes summer grazing in land that's half an hour down the road.
Last weekend, the 27-year-old took up her position as the new North West Vice President of the young farmers' organisation, Mocra na Ferma.
So I suppose I grew up on a farm in Italy, so we had dairy cows, we had pigs and we had hens as well. So it was only a very, very small farm, and I suppose I got an interest from farming there when I was younger. I used to help my grandfather out, and I suppose initially it's not really a thing for women to go into farming, so it was a very big decision for me to actually want to go ahead and pursue it in the future. So I knew at a very young age that I wanted to go to an ag college, I wanted to get more knowledge into the farming industry. And then obviously I met a Cavan man, and I started farming sheep in 2017, and then obviously 2 years ago I started off with cattle as well. So I'm kind of just building a business from here, and obviously taking on the role as Northwest Vice President with Mocra as well as my full-time job, so I'm balancing it all at the same time.
So you got a taste for it back in Italy, which is where your dad is from.
Yeah, Dad's actually from a little village called Casalvieri. It'd be an hour and a half from Rome, so it'd be bang on in the centre of Italy.
And is it still in the family back home?
No, my mum and dad sold on the farm, so now that we're living over here, we don't have the farm anymore. So I suppose that is a bit of a disappointment, but I suppose mum and dad didn't want to continue with the farm, and then that's why I'm building one up over here. So I've been farming here in Butler's Bridge since last year, but I started off farming in Swad in 2017. So I was leasing 30 acres up there, and now I'm leasing 30 acres here in Butler's Bridge.
God, you're very much a local when you're calling Swanland Bar Swad.
Oh, I know. So you have to take up the local lingo when you're living there.
Yeah, This is not Luna's first time in Countrywide. She spoke to us in 2018 after winning the FBD Young Sheep Farmer of the Year competition.
Whenever I was back from school or whenever I woke up in the morning, I'd go and I'd help my grandfather make cottage cheese at the back of the house, and we'd also make Parma ham, leave it drying out there for a couple of months in one of the sheds, and we used to sell the local produce to the local community, so we were supporting the local community.
Do you have a plan now going forward in terms of how you're going to develop this farm over the next 5 to 10 years, or is it difficult in the current climate to plan ahead?
I suppose the biggest thing with farming would be your land availability. So you can have your plan in your head, and my plan would be to extend the farm to milk ewes in the future, but it is all down to when the land becomes available to actually purchase it, because you need that land to build your parlour and have your land around the parlour to make it easy accessible for milking ewes, and that's the difficult part of extending your farming business. Mm.
But what about the policy changes that are coming down the road? Like, I'm sure you're well aware of the way farmers and environmentalists are fighting. It's quite unseemly. What's your take on all of that?
Well, I suppose, you know, you have your environmental policies coming in and you have to look for ways to become more green and more environmentally friendly. So I suppose myself, like, I'm looking towards introducing, and I have introduced in the past few months, I'm working on antibiotic-free farming. So looking at natural remedies as opposed to non-natural ones. So like using your parasite for your fluke and your worms, and using your Bioactin for, you know, your scouring your calves. So it's really looking towards introducing more and more of natural remedies, because obviously, you know, we have people who are becoming vegan and vegetarian, or maybe they're just refusing to have red meat or meat in general, and they're afraid of maybe cancers being present in the meat, and introducing natural remedies. You know, I'm really hoping that in the future that's really going to encourage more people to consume meat than what we have at the moment.
What are the other challenges facing young farmers, and indeed your members who are not farmers, young people in rural Ireland?
I suppose the biggest thing at the moment, especially with COVID, would be mental health. You know, we have our farmers and our members that are sitting at home on a Zoom call, and it's very hard for them to actually interact with people when it's through a screen. And even in the wider farming industry, you know, farming can be a very lonely job, especially for younger people. And now that they, you know, didn't really have many outlets to go to, you know, the markets were closed, you know, you couldn't really go into the factory, so you couldn't interact with many people. And farming can be very lonely, and that is the biggest challenge, is the mental health aspect of it. And it really is, when you're going into farming, you need to be aware of this, you need to be resilient towards it, because you need to understand that every day is not going to be the same, and you need to really reach out for help, especially now, because your mental health is most important.
Do you find it a lonely business at times?
I suppose I do. Like, there would be times when I would spend an awful lot of hours on my own, but I do have my full-time job. You know, I'm doing a PhD as well, so I have the college interaction and the mocker interaction. So most of the time for myself, and I'm lucky that I do have a daily interaction, whereas full-time farmers wouldn't have that as much as I do.
Mocker's membership is 10,000 17 to 35-year-olds, and it's the only farm organisation that has had a female president, Catherine Buckley, back in 2007. And the three new vice presidents elected for the next 2 years are women, alongside the national president, John Keane, from Tipperary.
I suppose if people see more female participation at a higher level within organisations, especially like Mocker and other farming organisations, it might encourage more female participation in the farming industry as well. And it might encourage more female entrance into farming.
Well, the very best of luck to you over the next couple of years in your position with Mark and a farm. And thanks a million for chatting to us, and the best of luck with the farming.
Thank you very much.
That was Luna Orofiama, cattle and sheep farmer and new vice president of Macrona Ferma.
This means that the UK has voted to leave the European Union.
Let June the 23rd go down in our history as our Independence Day.
And so the first real test of that Brexit independence came this week with the announcement of a free trade deal between Britain and Australia.
Why is he so frightened of free trade? I think there's a massive opportunity for Scotland and for the whole of the UK, and he should seize it and be proud of it.
But farmers in Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland, not to mention here in the Republic, are less jubilant with the idea of cheap food competing and flooding the UK from down under.
We're extremely worried about this. Volume is obviously a serious issue, as are standards. This oversupply that we could see happening and is likely to happen would completely undermine our market. So from an economic perspective, we're seriously concerned.
Martin Kennedy of the National Farmers Union in Scotland, echoing the sense of shock and concern among farmers across the United Kingdom. Steve Thompson is an agricultural economist, and he lectures the next generation of young Scottish agricultural students at Scotland's Royal College. And he joins us this morning from Scotland. Stephen, good morning. Were you surprised at the speed at which this new free trade deal with Australia has happened?
I suppose I was, and I wasn't. I was, because last year in the UK agricultural when the Agricultural Act was passing through Parliament, there was a requirement for future trade deals to be assessed and the impacts considered through the Trade and Agricultural Commission, which is still to be set up. So for this deal to come in before it's been scrutinised from an impact perspective was a bit of a fright, or a bit concerning. But I suppose the UK government have been keen to show that they're fleet of foot in comparison with the EU with regards to negotiations. And of course, the EU have been negotiating with Australia for the last 3 years, and Liz Truss has managed to come in and offer a deal in probably record time that shows that the UK means what they're saying in terms of trying to liberalise trade across the globe.
Okay, we heard there from Martin Kennedy saying how worried he is. That's been reflected and echoed in this country as well, in Northern Ireland indeed, and of course in Wales. What's central to farmers' concerns, and what is the significance and consequence of zero tariffs?
Well, I think central to the concerns, particularly in Wales and Scotland, who are, if you think of them as countries of their own or devolved administrations, they're significant net exporters of ruminant livestock. So Scotland's a massive net export into England and into the European Union of sheep meat and also of beef. And Wales is the same, particularly in the sheep meat sector. So with regards to Australia, it's a very low-cost production system for sheep. They've got both. It's a dual purpose. They've got wool and meat, which means that the economics stack up in their favour. And in the beef sector, they've also got a comparative advantage there. So naturally, farmers are looking at this trade deal thinking, my word, if there's zero tariff, that means that they've got a real cost comparative advantage, which means that they could be pushing us out of the market. I take a slightly different perspective on that, in that I think that they may push Irish exports out the market a bit more. And I always hark back to the 2019 announcement when the UK government announced their tariff schedule. They had a tariff rate quota for beef in there. And that tariff rate quota kind of mirrored what the European Union were currently exporting to the United Kingdom. Now, at some point, the concern, I think, across the industry is we've got an absolute free trade agreement with zero tariffs with the European Union. We are going to have a tariff-free regime maybe in 10 or 15 years, depending on how these negotiations go with Australia. And every other country is going to want a similar deal. So stacking all of that up means that there's increasing competition, and you can only it can only go one way, in that will push some of the smaller producers out.
Okay, so you're saying that the fear is that cheaper steaks from down under, where they can produce it at a low cost, maybe at half of what the EU average is, that it'll shove our beef off the supermarket shelves across the UK?
Potentially, and the devil is in the detail in trade negotiations and trade deals, and how people then react. So the trade deal is just the opening of a door. Somebody then has to come in and get that market penetration. Mm. And of course, the Irish processors are well established in the United Kingdom, so I would imagine that they'll have a say in some of this. But we know that the retail sector is quite fickle at times, and they will go for cheap. And the food manufacturing sector will go for cheap if possible. But I think the Australians will be very, very astute here and be using the very high end of their market, so strip loins, etc., fillet, and actually targeting that. Because if they've got increased access in terms of tonnage, then the tonnage, a ton of offal compared to a ton of fillet has got hugely different values. And of course, if you're being paying a tariff, a tax on value or on tonnage, then you would naturally go for the high end market wherever you can. So I think this will be perhaps into the high end market, the retail and also into the sort of food service, the hospitality sector, where they could be targeting that.
Yeah, and in other words, they'll be sending good stuff here. Won't be anything cheap. Finally and briefly, Stephen, the Brexiteers that were so patriotic back in 2016, voting to leave, will they be as patriotic now when it comes to supporting local farmers?
That's a $64 million question, and you hear very often that people will support the British producer and like local food, etc. But that's fine if you've got that choice and you're affluent. The challenge is that we've got an awful lot of people that don't have choice mm-hmm. when it comes to food purchases. They do purchase on price, and if there's a low value product on the shelf, then they will buy it. And we saw that during COVID, the first lockdown in COVID,
yeah.
when a lot of Polish beef came in and it was really cheap, and it flew off off the shelves.
Okay.
So consumers will tell you one thing and do something else quite often.
Okay, very interesting developments this week indeed. Thank you very much for joining us. That's Stephen Thompson, who's an agricultural economist lecturing young ag students at Scotland's Rural College.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by the Irish Farmers Journal. Get Irish Country Living, your magazine for rural Ireland, every week inside the Irish Farmers Journal.
Now, when my next guest, Bord Bia's Maureen Gahan, last spoke to me on the programme, it was 18 months ago, and we were wondering then if there was any end in sight for the growth of the food service sector in this country, because in November 2019, that sector had grown in 8 consecutive years and then accounted for about 1/3 of all food that we consume in this country. But those last 18 months have seen a reversal of fortune and uncertainty about the future for obvious reasons. Maureen's here. Good morning.
Good morning, Damien.
Good to see you again. Hard to believe it's 18 months since you were here, and we were talking about the growth of this sector. But just remind our listeners this area we're talking about. What does it include?
Sure. So when we talk about food service, it's food that is consumed or prepared out of home. So that includes everything from high street, you know, restaurants, coffee shops, pubs and hotels, but also things like food in workplace restaurants, on board trains and planes. So, yeah, as you say.
Anything we don't eat at home.
Anything we don't eat or we don't prepare. So also included are things like home delivery. But anything we don't buy in a supermarket, basically.
Well, by God, it's had some hit in the last 12 months.
Yeah, absolutely. As you say, 18 months ago had been growing for 8 consecutive years. We were talking about things like, you know, the market getting a bit saturated, prepare for a slowdown, but nobody saw the freight train that was coming around the corner. And, you know, when I talk about food out of home, and yet we've been told to stay in home for so long. So, you know, that gives you just an idea of how badly it's
Yeah, so the restaurants closed, mm-hmm. you know, the fast food outlets closed. We weren't driving in our cars, so we weren't going to the petrol station as much, and we started cooking from home. So are you able to quantify how that food service sector was hit?
And we know it didn't close 100%. We know obviously there'd been lockdowns and reopenings, but separate to that, there were some businesses that were able to trade throughout, particularly where they had off-premise sales. So by off-premises, we're talking about everything from takeaway to click and collect, you know, your order in advance, or home delivery. And those are the ones that have been able to trade regardless of the lockdown. So they have continued to do okay. And we've seen a lot of innovation in that space as well. But from a numbers point of view, at the beginning of 2020, so last year, the market was valued at menu prices of about 8.5 billion. At the end of the year, our report published in November suggested that it had fallen by 47%, so almost 50%, and down to 4.5 billion. And within that, I suppose some sectors within food service hit more than others.
Depending on geography, probably.
Depending on geography, to a certain extent, we know that city centres continue to be, you know, hit because obviously no tourists.
Yeah.
The fact that so many people working from home is affecting that. Third level students, you know, studying from home. So on the flip side of that, then we have seen some growth in both regional and suburban areas. But the other thing is that, as I mentioned before, certain sectors have been hit worse than others. So if you were in the events business, for example, catering at Croke Park or the Aviva Stadium, you know, that's just stopped. Weddings have stopped, obviously, to a certain degree. But then this whole off-premises, those that were able to transition, do things like home meal delivery kits, they've had, at least they've been able to, I suppose, keep the brand alive. And we've seen some creative offerings coming from that side of things.
Yeah, And I'm seeing a lot of these, you know, the caravan, car park, coffee, little outlets as well. Yeah. Is that part of the pivoting?
Absolutely, absolutely. Somebody said to me during the week that the hardest thing to find in a horse box these days was a horse. So I think we've all seen that. And coffee, it lends itself to take away, obviously. But also other offerings from, you know, your kind of your burgers or Mexican style, whatever the case may be. I mean, I know there's a chef called Chad Byrne from Killarney. Yeah. And he went to crowdfunding earlier in the year in order to fund a horse box, and he has one. It's called the Hungry Donkey, and that's been trading well over the last while. And the reason is, I mean, consumers, we've been stuck at home and we've been cooking three meals a day, and so we're just looking for any kind of an option to give us a break from that. And there's absolute pent up demand. We feel that, and we're confident that as the industry does reopen, we know hotels will reopen first from the 2nd of June, then outdoor dining from the 7th of June. No definite date yet for indoor dining, although widely expected and hopefully expected from early July. So we can, you know, we know there's a certain amount of consumer caution out there, but we also know there's pent up demand, and we've seen it in other markets as they reopened. You know, the UK are ahead of us.
Yeah.
In terms of both vaccine rollout and the reopening. Last Monday, they opened for indoor dining and they were reporting figures up 25% against 2019 figures. So, you know, we're kind of suggesting it might be a bit of a sugar rush. We'll see how it goes. But we would really be hopeful for a strong summer. One of the things that we're doing at the moment, actually, is we're out to trade interviews all this week and next. And we will be just basically looking at our November figures. We'll, on the 17th of June, be publishing a white paper, which gives a more definite figure for the predicted growth this year. We do know that the first 6 months have been, you know, I suppose, worse than we would have anticipated in terms of the length and the depth of the lockdown. But we're confident. I mean, the great news is that the vaccines are rolling out and they appear to be working in terms of the numbers in hospitals, notwithstanding the fact we know, we're very much aware, as is the industry and as our consumers, that the virus is still in the community. But yes, we would certainly see second half of 2021 being a lot more positive, and then we'll be looking into 2022 to see what that might translate as well.
Because you're talking about the horse boxes and the caravan selling the coffee and the toasties, and, you know, it's great to see, and there's great camaraderie at weekends, people queuing up and all of that, and being able to eat outdoors. And then there's these, is it kind of what you call ghost kitchens, dark or ghost kitchens as well?
Yeah, I mean, some of the trends that we've been speaking about for the last couple of years have absolutely accelerated in the face of COVID, because, you know, out of necessity. And the reference to dark or ghost kitchens, it's somewhat, you know, gives a perception of a little bit shady. But actually, all it means is that you're working from a kitchen that's not, you know, you don't have high street presence necessarily. And so we've seen it within Ireland, interestingly, on the whole workplace catering. Obviously, people still not yet back in offices. In some industries, they've had to continue. But some of those are looking at central production kitchens, where rather than having staffed kitchens on site, they can work from these. Effectively, they're ghost kitchens, because, and they then deliver in. Or from a high street point of view, we've seen examples of some restaurants, for example, that are using hotel kitchens that haven't been used to date to service based on the demographic. So if you want to get into a part of Dublin or Galway or wherever where there's a decent population demographics and you can do home delivery, but from a different kitchen, that's what we're talking about when we say ghost kitchens. And so, yeah, we have seen an increase in that.
All right. Well, before you go, Maureen, are we going to go back to the way we were? Or are there some trends here to stay? Like, you know, we're working from home. So a lot of those office workers that would have been buying sandwiches and
town. I mean, we think ultimately that will come back to, there's a big conversation, of course, of the home work balance and flexibility. I think realistically, we won't get back to 100%, but maybe we'll get back to, by 2022, 70, 80% with this flexible working model. So there will be people back in offices, for sure. Younger population, they want to get back in and socialise and go out after work. Just very quickly, Damien, from a producer point of view, what we say to the food and drink companies that we work with, it's all about the so what from these insights. What does that mean from your business? And many of them have been fantastic, because they've had the opportunity, maybe where their food service business collapsed, they've had the opportunity to go directly to consumers or find business at retail level. I mean, I guess the good news is everyone needs to eat. So, and we know there's a consumer demand, it's just getting to the consumer. But for a lot of them, we're now saying when you're back, start back trading with restaurants, you need to understand, we know labour is a huge issue. So do you, you know, and it's going to be more difficult for the hospitality sector as it reopens, trying to get staff back in kitchens and front of house. So if you have a product that can help on labour saving, if you have a product that lends itself well to takeaway, you know, if you have product for the kind of streamlined menus yeah. these guys will be working with. So, but in terms of consumer behaviours, we think some will stick and some will just go back to the way we right. were. I mean, for sure, the kind of the massive spike in home delivery, meal boxes, a lot of restaurants, when they open up to indoor dining, they won't be able to keep both. But there may be a certain element. And I think home delivery will continue. It'll probably just drop. It'll certainly drop against 2020. But yes, it'll be up against 2019.
Okay. And as you said there, the food retailers have had it really tough, but a lot of their suppliers have been able to innovate.
Yeah, and if you look at exports, I mean, it's not just in Ireland, obviously, with food service. We've seen globally a 33% drop in food service. We would have had beef, seafood, alcohol, dairy going out to restaurants around the world. And yet our overall exports last year only fell by 2%. Okay. So I think that's phenomenal. It just shows how, you know, hardworking resistance the Irish food industry is.
All right, Maureen, thank you very much indeed for that insight. And we'll keep an eye on the continuing, I suppose, trends that you're looking at there in Borbia, and well done for that. Maureen is one of the food exports experts included in the current KPMG Irish Farmers Journal Agribusiness Report, which was published this week. A lot of really interesting reading in that as well. Maureen, thanks very much.
Thank
and
you,
sure,
Maureen.
It won't be 18 months before we see you again. You're
and
welcome back here
we'll
anytime.
Have plenty of good news.
Hopefully indeed. Well, earlier we heard from Luna Orofiama from Machrana Ferma explaining how it can be so difficult for young farmers to get going because it's difficult to access suitable land. Now, Suzanne Campbell has been looking at the issue of land prices and how they've gone, because certainly the COVID-19 pandemic has seen a big shift in prices there. Suzanne, good morning to us. What have you got for us?
Yes, land prices, they've really risen actually in the last 18 months. You know, they rose 15% last year despite the COVID-19 pandemic. And, you know, land prices have reached an average price in Ireland of 10,300 an acre. And that's up from 8,900 an acre in 2019. And like, this is the highest jump in land prices since the financial crash of 2008. So I suppose the question is, who is buying land? And why is the demand so high? And, you know, we hear about cuckoo funds buying property in Ireland. And funnily enough, more and more land is not being bought by farmers, but actually by business people as an investment. And we'll hear about that in a couple of minutes. So I suppose one of the main reasons I'm hearing that land prices are going up is as usual, is that the demand is bigger than supply, basically. So why is less land coming onto the market? We know that in the pandemic, a lot of people weren't certain if they were going to sell land or houses. You know, I mean, they thought, well, what's the lending and banking scenario going to be following this pandemic? Should I put my land or my farm on the market right now? So that was one reason where reticence might have caused people to hold on to land and it didn't come up for sale. On the other hand, demand was very strong because a lot of people in urban or suburban areas wanted to move to the countryside, and that has happened to a degree, working from home somewhere else if they could. But the biggest losers, of course, are young farmers like Luna there, starting out in their careers, or active farmers who are looking for more land. Kieran McDonald is a young farmer. Farms with his mum and dad outside Dundalkin, County Louth, milking 64 cows. They have 40 acres at home. They rent more 12 acres 6 miles away, and they've 27 acres that they bought in 1982. That was the last time they were able to buy land. He graduated from Ag College 4 years ago, but it's just proven impossible for him or his family to get hold of more land so that they'd have a farm that could supply two incomes rather than one.
For a long time now in this area, land is very scarce. The last time there was any land for sale in the nearby area was 2019. It was two blocks. One block went for 18,000 an acre. Another block went for 20,000 per acre, which is very high. Recently, the Irish Farmers Journal put out the average price for the country and for County Louth. average land price of 12,000. So for there, we're in very high land price scenario.
Why is it so high in that area?
Traditionally, with a lot of dairy farms, so the big demand from dairy farmers. Also, there's a lot of tillage farmers in the area who are able to compete as well for that type of price. And recently, since Brexit, I'm only 6 miles from the border. We have a lot of competition from the north as well.
And for you and young farmers of your age, is it a big topic of discussion? And what would their experiences be that you hear?
Yes, a lot of my friends that I went to college with, a lot of them go home to farm with their parents and they all have to buy or lease land and they just can't get it. So it's very difficult for them to kind of enter into the full-time farming. For them then, it won't be until their 40s, early 40s before they'd be able to take over the farm fully until their parents retire. Mm. So that's kind of slowing down generation renewal.
One, two. Thank you.
The reason there is more demand than supply is that we're also between two cap cycles, Damien. You know, we hear the announcements on maybe the new shape of cap, you know, quite soon, maybe in August and September. But a lot of farms might have been reluctant to sell land if there are retirement schemes coming into play that they didn't know about before, didn't have access to before, that's in the new cap. Another element is that land now, of course, as I said earlier, is not being bought by farmers, but a lot of it is being bought by business people as an investment. I talked to Tom Cross of GVM Auctioneers. They're based in Limerick. They're involved in mart sales and livestock, but also land sales. And they sell on average year about 1,500 acres. But this amount that they sell is declining because more and more land is going into lease as well. So I asked Tom why he's seen more land being leased rather than sold.
I suppose the big attraction for most landowners is that they can retain their asset. They can pop their land into a long-term lease. They can avail of the tax benefits associated with long leases, which are very, very attractive. So effectively, they can assume their rental income tax-free. They can also combine that tax-free income and integrate the single farm payment. So you can obviously see the attraction in it for landowners. They can retain the land in the family. They can avail of the increased rents, by the way, which are very, very evident in recent years as well. So that does inhibit the market. And I would say it's probably reduced the land take going to the market by maybe 30% or so per year.
And if it's tax-free, so basically what you're saying is if a person has a house that they let, they pay tax on that rental income. If you've land and you let it, you don't. Is that right?
Effectively, if you have house property or commercial property, you pay tax depending on your tax rate at 42 cents in the pound plus PRSI. So 50% of your income is diluted immediately on taxation. However, the benefits of land letting is that, yes, you can assume your rental income tax-free. Leases of 5 years or more, you can get a threshold of 18,000 plus on your income. And if the land is jointly owned, that can be doubled, which is very, very attractive. I think what we're also seeing is a return to the market of business people who are now beginning to raise their eyebrows and look at land as being a potentially good investment. They see it as a very, very safe haven for their money, which they're now being charged for in banks. And they're looking at land as being potentially an investment opportunity that they can buy, they can rent it, they can lease it, and they can again get their income tax free. Again, albeit, I suppose, the return and the yield wouldn't be as attractive as residential or commercial property, but the asset base is very, very safe.
It makes sense that land being bought is being bought as investment, you know, because the economies of buying land for food production just don't stack up. You know, if you're a new farmer starting out, it's impossible to make money back from food. It could take two generations to pay for the farm. But one third of Irish farmers are over the age of 66, and a lot of those farmers have no successor, no one to take over the farm. And the Macrina Fermor Land Mobility Service started in 2015. It's a way of bringing younger farmers and older farmers together who might be able to farm together or lease the land on some scheme. Austin Finn from the service told me more about how it works.
So the space we fill in is where there's landowners who are looking to step back. They may not have a farming successor within the family. And then we help match them up with young people who are looking for land. And the type of arrangements that they end up being is usually something like a long-term lease, partnerships, or some sort of land share. It was all very new in 2015 and it was supported by extra tax reliefs at the time. And since then, there's been greater awareness and there's far more of this sort of thing going on.
Right. How do you tend to find the relationships? Obviously, there's contracts and it's legally set out, but does the relationship work in the main?
Yeah, it's usually outside the family. So there are people not related. Some would have not known each other before the thing started. So there is a process in trying to make these things work. So typically how it works is when a landowner engages with us, we will look for expressions of interest and we would have young people in our database. And then we will return to the landowner with, say, maybe 10 or 12, these are people who would be interested in talking to you about some sort of thing. And the landowner will sort of select from those. Yeah, there's five or six there I'd love to talk to. And it's quite a long process. So that process allows them to get to know each other and to build up a relationship. And because we have that process, then we sort of deal with a lot of the potential pitfalls. And obviously there's a contract, but if you end up having to refer back to the contract a year into it, you're nearly in trouble.
How long would these leases typically be for?
It will depend on every farm and the circumstances, but typically you're looking at 10, 15 year arrangements and longer if there is a need for investment for the person coming in or joint investment, you know, so every arrangement is different and we build it up. But found when landowners identify the right type of person, you can be amazed how flexible they can be to allow the thing to work for both sides.
Interesting stuff there from Austin Finn of Markerna Fermanagh's Land Mobility Service, ending that report from Suzanne Campbell. Suzanne, thank you very much for that. Now, they're a bit late this year, but in County Limerick, Catherine Quinn and her granddaughter Hannah have been planting potatoes. The rituals of the season open a store of memories and reconnect both Hannah and Catherine to the past.
I'm going to put one at the very end.
Go on, do. We'll see. You don't waste an inch when it comes to potatoes, do you know that? I love kind of the black richness of the soil and putting
and
them
the
in.
And the feel of it. The feel of it, it's lovely.
It just crumbles in your hand at the minute. So the reason why I'm so late putting the main crop into the ground is because they're a fancy blight-resistant variety. Because, like all Irish people, I live in fear of blight. So they took a bit longer to chit. Is this how you would have done it when you were planting potatoes as a child?
Well, no. I suppose from the point of view that my father would open the drills with a horse and plough, and we'd plant half an acre at least, or maybe more, to feed the family for a whole year.
Great-grandpa went away to England at one stage to work because he had to work on the railroads because there wasn't enough money coming in. I mean, what did that do to the whole dynamic?
Well, my brother, at I suppose the age of 11 or 12, he took over doing... he took over the ploughing.
But you just have only potatoes in the course of a day?
Sometimes, yes. You know, we would have bacon and cabbage for the main meal and with potatoes. But then on occasions, we would just have potatoes, a big pot of potatoes.
One big pot of potatoes in the middle of the table.
Yes.
And
yes.
Nine children reaching out to get them.
Yes. And my mother if it was a big pot, she would just lift the pot and just tip them onto the middle of the table. And we'd all dive in. We'd be sitting there ready to go. And you'd absolutely make sure you wouldn't miss dinner time, because if you did, you'd go hungry, probably.
I mean, great-granny, she sounds like such a tough woman. And I think of her every year when we're planting potatoes, because of that story that you told me when she was out working in the fields and she realised that she was having a miscarriage.
Yes, that's right. I remember that, maybe probably because I'm the eldest and also because I was with her at the time. So we were planting potatoes. And she became aware that something was wrong, and she indicated to me that we'd have to go back to the house.
How did she know that something was wrong? Well, did she kind of cry out? Was it sore?
No, she didn't cry out, but, it was obvious, from her legs, down her legs, it was obvious something was very, very wrong.
Was she bleeding?
Yes. So she indicated to me that we'd have to go back to the house. I just have this memory of her propping up the bottom of the bed, lifting it up slightly, and she went to bed for a day or two. I'm not sure what her idea was about propping up the bed, whether she knew something that I didn't know or what. I really don't know about that. But she went to bed for a day or two. I think the other children in the house didn't even know what was going on. And then after that, didn't go to see a doctor. Didn't seem to, as if she told anybody, really. And she carried on as normal.
Was great-grandpa away at that stage?
He was, actually.
So she was by herself?
Yes, he was away. Yes. He was. So,
I mean, were you upset?
I can't say that I was, really. I didn't really understand, do you know?
I always think of her. Mm. I always think about how strong she was, how strong you are.
Mm. She was, yeah. She loved you. You were her.
That was our first great grandchild. I didn't have much competition.
No, you didn't. Because she didn't have any more before she died. You were the only one. So yeah, she was very careful of you. And I remember the first time she took you for a walk in the pram. Oh, and she was so proud. And I can still see her to this day with the pram, and she was all business, off she went with her pram down the avenue, and it was so lovely. But I can just see her gait, I suppose you'd call it, as she pushed her pram with confidence and pride. It was lovely. It's 29 years now since she passed away, and I just can't believe that much time has gone by and that I'm the same age as she was when she died. I'm very aware of that for some reason. I don't know why. I suppose it's a natural thing to think of. But, we had lots of happy times here. And she just loved this place. And I feel her presence. Whatever's in it. I feel a connection with her. Well done.
Okay. Next one. And the bird's amazing.
Yeah, poignant memories being shared there between Hannah Quinn Mulligan and her grandmother, Catherine Quinn, who remembers her own late mother, also called Catherine Quinn there, as both of them planted potatoes on the farm there in County Limerick during the week. Thanks to Hannah for that recording, and to Catherine too. That's all we have time for this week. Today's programme was produced by Eileen Herron. Jamie Doyle was on sound and Brian Moss was our broadcast coordinator. Now stay tuned for Playback with Sinead Mooney coming up after the 9 o'clock news here on Radio 1. And until I talk to you at the same time next week, bye-bye, and thanks for listening.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by the Irish Farmers Journal. Get Irish Country Living, your magazine for rural Ireland, every week inside the Irish Farmers Journal.